You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English. For more information, visit studylegalenglish.com.
Hello and welcome to the Study Legal English podcast. I'm your host Louise and today I've got Mark Anderson on the show. In this interview, we cover a lot of stuff related to contracts in general and also specifically to IP contracts, intellectual property contracts. General contract topics we cover are the changing use of template contracts, the importance of the governing law and jurisdiction clauses, and the dangers of including common law concepts in civil law contracts. I know a lot of you listeners are from civil law jurisdictions, so this is certainly something that you need to pay attention to. The specifics about IP contracts we cover are specific legal English terms you need to know for licensing agreements, and we also go into detail on grant back clauses. If you need to up your vocabulary on intellectual property law contracts, then certainly stay tuned. Listen to the interview in full. And of course, if you're a bit confused about what grant back clauses are, then certainly you need to listen to this too. Finally, we briefly talk about the relationship between Mark and Ken Adams. The two of them have a long-standing relationship. They're always commenting on each other's posts. They're coming into conflict sometimes. And we talk a little bit about the differences in their personalities and also their approach to contracts. So, a quick announcement before we hear the interview. If you're a member, you'll get your transcripts for this episode, and if you're a pro member, you'll get even more benefits. Very exciting. Head over to studylegalenglish.com/episode98 for all of those. And of course, over at that link, studylegalenglish.com/episode98, you will also find all of the links which we mention throughout the interview. So now let's hear the interview. It's probably easier to say what Mark isn't than to say what he is. I could probably sum it up by saying he's the UK's expert on IP contracts. He is a UK qualified barrister and a UK qualified and practicing solicitor. He has over 35 years of experience as a commercial lawyer and is the managing partner of his own law firm, Anderson Law LLP. Mark is widely recognized as a leading lawyer in life sciences transactions and intellectual property, and he chairs a number of organizations. And how can he be helpful to you, my listeners? He's got a very good blog called IP Drafts, spelled D-R-A-U-G-H-T-S. It's got lots of helpful articles about contract drafting, and especially if you're interested in the field of IP, intellectual property, it's also got specific content for that field. He's also authored and co-authored quite a lot of good books, two of which I recommend you go out and buy today. They are called Drafting and Negotiating Commercial Contracts and The A to Z Guide to Boilerplate and Commercial Contracts. I've got both of these books and they're super helpful. I refer to them when I get questions from listeners about contract drafting, and as well if I'm preparing any courses on contracts, then they're super helpful to delve into and get the know-how from the expert himself. I also should say he delivers a lot of training. So if you're interested in getting some training specifically on contract drafting, then certainly do connect with Mark. He's quite active on LinkedIn. I'll leave all of the details, links in the show notes. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Louise. This is a new experience for me, so I'm looking forward to it.
Lovely to have you on the show. I know that you've got so much to share. Let's go ahead with the questions. Something that I ask most of my guests is, how did you get to where you are today. So what was your journey?
Law degree, qualified as a barrister, as you mentioned. Did a pupillage, which is, for your listeners, is the training that barristers have for a year. Decided that I was probably better at talking to clients than talking to judges as a 23-year-old. And went into industry as an in-house lawyer for 3 years. Then I joined a big specialist IP law firm in London called Bristow's. I was there for 7 years. And then I set up on my own in 1994. So that's the sort of professional side. And then I decided to write a book on technology transfer back in the 90s. And that was published in 96 and is now in its third edition. And that just led to invitations to write other books. Fortunately, I have an associate now, Victor Warner, who updates most of our books. So I don't have to struggle with that to the same extent. Gradually, it builds up. And then you end up at the age of 60 and you think, I've done all this. What do I do next? And of course, the answer to that is appear on your podcast.
The culmination of all your successes have led you here. You're so modest. You've really done such a lot. So you mentioned that you started off in-house. You then worked for a law firm and then founded your own law firm. What are some of the differences between working in-house and then in a law firm and then compared to actually running your own firm?
Okay. I was pretty young when I was working in-house and I was the sole in-house lawyer. I would say I was teaching myself quite a lot over 3 years, as well as the sort of being part of a commercial team. And that was all very interesting, learning how to work with commercial colleagues and so on. Then when I went to Bristow's, there's an expression going native, which I'm not sure how politically correct that phrase is nowadays, but I think I was criticized by one or two of the stuffier partners for being too commercially minded, too willing to bend. And the attitude in a rather traditional firm is, or was, you let the client take the commercial decisions, you point out the risks, but you make sure you have a good file note that you have never taken a commercial decision because you do not want to be sued if that commercial decision is wrong. Now, I've always tried to try to be as helpful as possible with clients, and so perhaps bend a little more than that attitude would suggest. But there are certain differences that I had to relearn in private practice that I just worked it out for myself as an in-house lawyer. And sometimes you just need to say no to the client. I read an awful lot of articles by in-house lawyers emphasizing how much they're there to find solutions and to be helpful and not to be a break on commercial activity and so on. And yes, up to a point, that's right. But I think there is also an element of standing back and being a little bit independent, being a little bit not part of the team and saying, this is wrong, this is unethical, or this is not going to work. Another expression, there's a bit of groupthink that gets into any sort of team, that everybody supports one another and takes the same view of the world. And sometimes I think the lawyer's role is to point out that the emperor's got no clothes. So it's that balance of making sure that you are as helpful as possible and responsive and so on, but also willing to stand up and become unpopular and say, no, this is not right. I disagree with this. So that's a little bit of a tension, but it isn't necessarily a bad thing.
And then did things change when you started your own firm?
Yes. Essentially, within 6 months of starting up my own firm, my top five clients from Bristow's days had joined me. And what they got was exactly the same service, but with 2/3 of the price and a more relaxed lawyer who didn't have to please 10 partners. For me, that was a major improvement. And I just kept going after that. The firm has gradually grown over the years. We're now up to 15 people. Nothing dramatic has happened over that time. It's just been a steady general increase over time.
So we've covered a bit about your background and now moving into what you write a lot about, what you do your training on is about, well, contracts. And so something that you've written a lot about on your blog and you've got your book about boilerplates inside contracts. Why should firms be using template contracts and what are the limitations of them?
Okay. When I started in practice, there were very few template agreements around. And indeed, some of the senior partners at Bristow's were very dismissive of template agreements, saying that you should always think through the deal and you shouldn't just rely on some document that somebody else produced for different circumstances. I personally think that wasn't the best approach, because I think templates can be very useful. But having said that, I think what some of them were thinking about was the published version of the Encyclopedia of Forms and Precedents, as it was. Back in those days, there was a green-bound set of template agreements in this encyclopedia. In fact, nowadays, it's a sort of blue and grey and gold equivalent. And in fact, we have done some of the agreements, for example, on research and development agreements, which we created for them in a much more modern style. So I think it depends on the quality of the template, first of all, as to how useful they can be. Second thing is, how standard is the deal? For example, if you're selling a company, the same issues come up time and time again. People spend a lot of time negotiating about warranties and indemnities. And I think there are some types of transaction that lend themselves quite well to, actually, I think sometimes in city law firms, you're more of a kind of process manager than a deal doer. And so template agreements can be very useful. But having said that, you do need to make sure that they reflect, you know, the deal that you're doing. And certainly in a lot of the intellectual property related deals that I do, there's a lot of creativity. This isn't coming from the lawyers, it's coming from the commercial people. Oh, we're going to have a collaboration. And well, what happens if you come up with an invention? Or there's all kinds of new situations that might arise that aren't always dealt with in the same way. And so you need to be able to draft to reflect those situations. It's a combination of taking a well-drafted template agreement where somebody has thought through the issues and drafted it in clear modern English, but then doing some creative drafting as well. Another thing that I would say about templates is I see an awful lot of people using some old document that looks like it was originally drafted in the US being used outside the US. Now, one can debate the merits or otherwise of US-style drafting, but when it appears in, say, a civil law contract, an Italian law contract, where somebody has used an American template just because they've seen that sort of template before, and it has a lot of legal language in it around things like representations and warranties and indemnities and time shall be of the essence and all kinds of legal expressions that perhaps don't have any, you know, real meaning within the context of the Italian civil code. So I think particularly with more the legal type clauses in contracts, it's quite dangerous to use a template that hasn't been drafted with your own jurisdiction in mind. The law jurisdiction clause appears at the end of the contract, so it tends to get negotiated as one of the last things in the course of the negotiations, whereas actually it should be one of the first things that's negotiated, and it should not be treated like a trade-off. Okay, you want to be paid within 45 days rather than 60 days. We'll give you that in return for Brazilian law and jurisdiction. It just is more important than that. It may not be the most important thing. What is to be done under the contract and what is to be paid is perhaps the most important thing, but I think it's the next level down. And it's not always given that level of importance by commercial negotiators.
I guess you're right. It's often towards the end of the contract, it's shoved away and not given very much importance. And I suppose from the commercial side, a lot of businesses would be of the position that problems aren't going to happen. That's only if a problem arises, and that's probably not going to happen. So let's just focus on the other stuff.
Nobody wants to think about the bad things when they're negotiating a deal. They want to focus on the opportunity and the positivity and the divorce. Doing the prenup is not really something that they want to think about.
You mentioned specifically that someone might find a random US template contract that's got wording like time is of the essence and things like that, and then they're applying it to a jurisdiction where that concept doesn't exist. Yeah. What would you suggest that they do instead? If they find a contract with that kind of wording, I guess the answer is don't use one of those templates. But what would you suggest is the better thing to do?
With a lot of these things, it's thinking about it in advance and not just grabbing the nearest document, but actually thinking, well, in what jurisdictions are each of the parties? Perhaps go for an agreement that's suitable for one of those jurisdictions. But having said that, there are, in international business, there are an awful lot of Anglo-American style agreements, or what the French would call Anglo-Saxon style agreements, which does sometimes limit your opportunities. But perhaps the thing to do is, when you're preparing your first draft, perhaps just think about whether there is magic legal wording in there that reflects a different jurisdiction, and perhaps just take it out or spell out what the obligation is. For example, time is of the essence. What does it mean? An awful lot of people in the UK who are negotiating contracts with that phrase in don't actually know what it means. And I know this because I've asked the question many times in my training courses. There's a vague sort of feeling, oh, it means it's an important obligation, but they're missing the actual legal significance, which is that it makes it what traditionally is called a condition in English law, as distinct from a term or a warranty, and therefore you can terminate if you fail to comply with it. So it's a rather old-fashioned way of saying it's an essential term of the contract for which a strict compliance is required, failing which you can terminate the contract. So if you've got a phrase like that, why not spell out what the arrangement is, which is, you know, if you fail to meet this deadline, we can terminate the contract. That way you avoid using the legal jargon that's built up in a particular jurisdiction.
So that's a great thing to do, listeners, when you're faced with language like a phrase that you think, what does that mean? Don't just think, oh, I'm going to put it in there because it sounds nice and legal and I'll sound very intelligent, like I'm using legal English in a great way. Look at what the phrase means so that you actually know the context of it, and then think, is that what you want in your contract? Does that even exist in your jurisdiction or the jurisdiction that governs the contract? And then if that's not what you want, spell it out in clear, plain language. And so, talking about templates, imagine that you are a non-native English-speaking lawyer based in, you know, Brazil or wherever. You are exactly doing what you've said. You're grabbing some contract here and there, a template contract that you don't really understand, but you recognize that and you actually want to change and you want to use better templates. Maybe you want to create a bank of templates or a bank of boilerplate clauses. What would be your advice for someone in that position?
I guess it partly depends on what their circumstances are. And if they're working for a big law firm or a big legal department, then they may be given the time and space to be the drafting expert within the department, and then they can come up with a set of standard clauses or templates. And in doing that, there's not really any substitute for looking at some old examples, some other examples, working out what the principle is, and then working out a straightforward way of saying it. And that indeed is what we have done with some of our template agreements that have been published. There's a loose leaf on the far end of the shelf behind me, which is called Drafting Agreements in the Biotechnology and Pharmaceutical Industries. And that's got, I think, something like 36 template agreements in it. And what I did when I got the commission to write that was I employed somebody full-time for a year as a research assistant to draft the template agreements. And I would give this person examples of three or four ones that I thought were quite good for the area of activity. And he went away and basically came up with the first draft. And I then would look at it and change it as I thought appropriate. Now, I had a very good research assistant there who'd been somebody who'd been almost appointed as a trainee, but didn't come to the top of the pile, as it were. And he had, in a previous life, been an English lecturer at Oxford. He was very good on language and on getting things, even if he didn't have the legal training. So that's how we got a set of template agreements there. It's hard work. I was employing him full-time for a year to get 36 templates out of it. You know, that gives you an idea of the scale of the work that's involved in getting things right. Another thing, of course, you can do is you can use Ken Adams' Manual of Style and Contract Drafting, which has an exhaustive list of recommendations on how to express things. So I think whoever's doing it needs to be quite good at words and quite thoughtful about whether what they're saying is ambiguous or needs to be adjusted. These are all just the the skills of contract drafting, really. You go through the draft time and time again, tweaking the word order, changing a word here or there, just to improve the clarity and avoid any potential argument as to the meaning. And ultimately, it's just a lot of hard work, basically.
What could be some ideas is, you know, if you're working in a big law firm, great. Like you suggest, maybe there's budget to employ someone to come in and do the templates. If you're perhaps someone who has less of a budget, then do some training on contract drafting. Get some books. Okay, you mentioned Ken Adams's Manual of Style for Contract Drafting. Your books as well. You mentioned the one with the templates, which we'll certainly leave a link in the show notes too. That sounds like a really helpful one. And I feel like your book, The Drafting and Negotiating Commercial Contracts, is the UK perspective of Ken Adams's Manual of Style. It's slightly different.
The introductory level, and it reflects my style rather than Ken's.
Yeah, you've both got certainly different styles. And get a book and also a trainer or someone that you trust that you can actually go through the contracts with, maybe a legal English teacher, something like that, or another lawyer who can help you through the process. So let's move on. So I had a few questions come in from members of my Facebook group who were very interested that I was interviewing you. One of them is from Marina Saad in Egypt. She's a fresh graduate of law. And she asked, what are some typical drafting issues in IP contracts? So what are some typical clauses that go in? What words do we need to be careful of? What shouldn't we use? And I know that you've got articles about this specifically on your blog. Can we maybe talk about that?
Sure. My general take on IP agreements is that they're about 10% specialist IP issues and 90% general contracts. If a dispute arises under an IP agreement, it's probably more likely to be not an IP issue, but about whether royalties have been calculated correctly or whether valid notice of termination has been given or whatever. We've obviously got the example of Lionel Messi in all the newspapers as to whether he is validly given notice to terminate his contract to provide footballing services to Barcelona. That's just a straight interpretation of a contract issue. So some of the IP-specific wording issues that come up would be, what are you actually doing with your IP? Are you transferring ownership of it, in which case the correct word is assign the IP? Or are you simply, you know, are you retaining ownership and granting somebody some limited rights to use your IP, in which case typically the correct expression is license the IP? And so assignment and license are two key words that should be used correctly in IP agreements. I do sometimes see, come back to the example of the old-fashioned US template, where you see assignments that have a big long string of verbs that say the IP owner hereby assigns, conveys, makes over, transfers, and a whole load of other verbs. And really you don't want any of that other stuff. You just want a single correct word, which is assign the IP. So that's an issue. Another word that comes up in assignments is, are you hereby assigning, or are you merely agreeing or undertaking or promising to assign? Because the hereby assigns indicates that the transfer of ownership is happening now as a property transaction, whereas agrees to assign or shall assign is merely a contractual promise that in the future you will transfer the property. So being clear about that in IP agreements is important. Then you sometimes get in licenses a huge long list of adjectives. Party A hereby grants a license, but it's not just a license, it's a worldwide, irrevocable, blah, 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 blah license. And actually, that's a kind of shorthand. And one of the problems with contract drafting is people are too fond of shorthand expressions. Rather than say it's a worldwide exclusive, blah, 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 sub-licensable license, no, take out that word sub-licensable, because actually that's an important issue that you want to address in a whole clause, not just in a throwaway word as part of a long list of descriptions of a license. So you then have a separate clause that says the circumstances in which you can sub-license. Do you need to get the IP owner's prior approval of the sublicense? What terms do you have to include in the sublicense? For example, do you need to pass on any audit clauses? If the sublicensee is the one that's selling licensed products and a royalty is being paid based on those sales, the IP owner, although they don't have a direct contractual relationship with the sublicensee, may nevertheless want to have some rights to audit the sublicensee to ensure that they're getting the appropriate royalties. So there's loads of practice points around the detail of IP agreements that we could spend a lot of time talking about.
You made some brilliant points there. I really love those points that you made, especially the use of hereby. I think a lot of listeners, a lot of legal English learners get hung up with these here and there words, and they like to just throw them in because they think they sound legal.
I strongly dislike here and afters and where to fors and all of that stuff. I would chuck out and not include in the contract. But the one exception I would make is to use the word hereby as a flag or a signal to say whatever it is happening now, and usually what it is a transfer of ownership of property. It is probably less necessary when it's just an obligation, because the obligation is in the contract. You don't just say hereby undertakes to send a royalty statement. You just say shall send a royalty statement. Hereby is redundant there. But when it comes to the formal transfer of property, is it happening now or is it merely a promise to do so? I think the word hereby in a very disciplined way is a useful thing to include.
That's an excellent point, and I completely am on board with what you say. Don't use these here-there words, but use hereby with discipline when you right now are transferring the IP there right now by that contract. That's a really good way and the correct way to use it. You mentioned very helpful points about the difference in language between assign, meaning to give the IP, and then compared with license, which is just giving some rights to use the IP. You mentioned don't use all of these verbs. Don't use conveys, assigns. Okay, you might think it sounds legal, but it could potentially get you into trouble. The reality is that it's confusing. And one word, assign or license, is perfectly correct. You mentioned about the use of adjectives, that some people might have the habit of putting in a lot of adjectives before the word license, like worldwide, irrevocable, exclusive, or whatever license. Take all of that out. Just use license, and then use specific clauses to actually detail what you mean by what you were going to say using adjectives.
Louise, I don't see things in black and white, so I have a degree of tolerance of this. It's just sometimes it gets too extreme, and my example of sublicense, I think, is a good one. But I'm not going to tell people you can't say a worldwide license because there isn't really any other issue to talk about there. So it's quite a subtle message, really, of just standing back from the wording and saying, is this clear? Part of the problem is when you get like 10 adjectives before the word license, it just makes it very difficult to get your head around what exactly is being said. So it's a sort of general lighter touch, really, rather than a sort of heavy legalistic phraseology.
I'm sure that because you're a working lawyer, you're compassionate to the fact that lawyers are busy people, and that even though you might really wish to have this perfect contract, but the reality is that you're not going to spend your life working away over this very difficult job of trying to make it perfect. So sometimes those words slip in, but it's a good tip to say, look, stand back. Is it clear? What are the changes that you can make? And you mentioned some of them there, so very helpful. Moving on to another question from a listener. This was Fernanda Vitarelli. I don't know if I've pronounced her name correctly. She's a legal English teacher and translator in Brazil. She asked quite a specific question. How common are grant back clauses? And what's the best way to draft them? Now, I think it would be helpful for you to say what a grant back clause is. I can make an educated guess, but I certainly think it would be helpful if you explain it.
Sure. These clauses arise typically in license agreements where the licensee may be further developing the technology or the IP. They may have created something during the lifetime of the license. So, for example, if it's a pharmaceutical drug that's effectively being licensed to a pharmaceutical company, and the licensee has to do the clinical trials. We're all very aware from the newspapers about the clinical trials going on for COVID-19 vaccines at the moment. So the licensee is doing the clinical trials and will generate new information in the course of those trials, which may just be the regulatory data that has to be submitted before you can get a product license, or it may be new inventions, the best dosing regime for this product, which we haven't previously patented, is to dose it once a day in a small quantity rather than in one big pill every 3 months. So there could be new IP being generated. So the question then arises, who owns that new IP and what's the deal in terms of who can use it? And this arises both during the lifetime of the license and after the license has come to an end. And so let's just take the simple example of after the license agreement has come to an end, the original IP license is terminated, so the IP reverts to the original IP owner. But what about this new stuff that the licensee has generated? Should it also go back to the original owner so that they can then find, say, another pharmaceutical company to license? We've terminated you guys because you didn't perform well. We now want to take our IP back and license it to someone else. But you've had 5 years product development. We need that back as well. So we would get some sort of assignment or license back of the new IP that the licensee has generated. So those clauses are quite common. They do raise competitional issues, though. And as an IP contracts lawyer, when I hear the term grant back, the first thing that goes through my head is European competition law, which has something to say about grant back clauses, and particularly in the block exemption regulation for technology transfer agreements. Article 5 talks about not getting block exemption or not getting the safe harbour, because this technology transfer regulation provides a safe harbour from breach of European competition rules. You do not get the safe harbour if you have an exclusive license back of new IP or an assignment back of new IP. You need to think about, is a non-exclusive license back good enough? Or can we make out our case that even though it's not given a block exemption, we could argue that it's pro-competitive from general principles? So grant back clauses by themselves are easy enough to draft. And let's take another area of IP business, which is franchising. Let's say you're franchising your burger network. There is a strong argument for saying, all the franchisees, if they come up with some new IP, you season the burger after you've fried it, or rather before, and that isn't in the original Bible of instructions, that should be assigned back to the franchise owner so that they can then make it available to all the members of the franchise network. Now, that's a sort of economic argument for saying it's actually best if it's in one place rather than scattered across worldwide franchisees. So that would be where a grant back clause might still run into competition or problems, but you can see the logic of it a bit more clearly. That's one of the areas of thinking that's required on IP license agreements.
So when you were talking about the European competition law and the grant back clause, not sure if I completely understood. I might have to clarify a few things.
Well, if any of your listeners are aware of Article 101 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, that prohibits anti-competitive agreements. And you can be fined up to 10% of your worldwide turnover if you have an anti-competitive agreement. And so over the years, the European Commission has come up with a guide to what they consider to be anti-competitive. And they've also come up with these block exemption regulations. There's a set of clauses or types of clause that if you include those clauses, you're not going to get the benefit of the block exemption or the safe harbour. So as a practicing transactional IP lawyer, I need to have alarm bells ringing in my head if I see clauses in a license agreement that I think might fall outside the block exemption, because although it doesn't automatically mean that you're going to be in breach and be fined and have a non-binding agreement, there's a bigger risk of that. And therefore, having an awareness of what is allowed or not allowed under the relevant block exemptions is an important tool of the trade to know what you can include. So that's why I say, when I hear the expression grant back, the number one, the synapse is going through my brain, say, think about European competition law, because grant back clauses can be problematic.
Okay, so I think I've got it now. So Article 101 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union prohibits anti-competitive agreements within the European Union. So if an agreement is caught by Article 101, it's unenforceable. And as you said, you may have to pay a fine of up to 10% of your worldwide turnover. However, there are block exemptions. There is a block exemption regulation related to technology agreements, which sets out which types of technology agreements and clauses may be exempt from this Article 101, and therefore these agreements will be valid. And this includes, so, you know, these clauses are allowed, non-exclusive grant back clauses. However, exclusive grant back clauses are potentially not allowed. They're not included within the exemption regulation. They have to be assessed on an individual basis. Okay, so thank you for clarifying it. So we've talked a little bit about the kind of language that you should and shouldn't use. We've mentioned some of the issues in IP drafting and also about this specific question about the grant backs. So you mentioned earlier Ken Adams. I see you as another authority on contract drafting. Sometimes you give a UK perspective, whereas Ken is more focused on the US, although I know he does bring in UK drafting as well on his blog, but you're often commenting on his blog. So you two have got this history, and Ken writes up sometimes about the agreements or the disagreements that you've had on his blog. And I saw a recent post of you two having a conversation on Zoom about the differences between you two. How is it that you see the differences? What's Ken? What are you? How do you position yourselves?
Well, first of all, I think of Ken as a friend, and I'm very supportive of what he does. But we have different personalities, and Ken has slaved away working out what he considers to be the best contract drafting usage across dozens, if not hundreds, of very specific issues. And I think his approach is to say this is right and this is not right, or this is suboptimal. Whereas I'm a practicing lawyer, and as I think you mentioned earlier, I've got some sympathy for the practical realities of you're in the middle of a transaction. You can't necessarily go for perfection. You've got to go with something that's pragmatic and works. And so it sounds a little bit pompous, but I'm more shades of grey rather than black and white in my approach to things. I think that's really the difference. Also, I'm prepared to stand up and say if I disagree, whereas a lot of people, you know, are not prepared to do so. I think that's it, really.
Yeah, I know Ken's very hard line, but I absolutely know where he's coming from. It's really important to have people who have the vision and who are driving forward change. And then it's also important to have people who are actually practicing lawyers who are putting some of these ideas into practice and making changes, perhaps not of the standard which Ken aspires to, but still making change.
The other thing, and this isn't specific to Ken, is I like a good intellectual argument without getting emotional about things. And I can distance my personal feelings from the actual argument. I've learned over the years, I get into trouble sometimes with that, because an awful lot of people in the world, they do get emotionally attached to their positions and think that I'm personally attacking them, when I'm not. I'm just debating the intellectual issue, but I'm continuing to learn that I sometimes need to be more diplomatic with these things.
Okay, is there anything else, any burning tips, resources that we haven't mentioned, words that you think are great or terrible
Some of these issues have been aired on my blog over the years. One of the more popular articles on the blog, which has been going now for 9 years, is, I can't remember the exact title, but it uses the phrase the three R's, and that focuses on words like rectify and repudiate and other words that are quite obscure words, but sometimes feature in legal texts, revoke. And I can't always remember the exact technical difference between them, which is why I found writing that particular blog article quite useful, because it forced me to research the points and work out what exactly the differences were. So if, for example, you have a right to terminate a contract because of the other's breach in some form, are you just terminating or are you repudiating the contract, or is the other party repudiating the contract? Are you rescinding the contract? These are very technical legal expressions that the vast majority of the population won't be using, words like rescind and repudiate and revoke, and actually working out what the difference is, because they may have significant differences. One might mean you are just terminating and what's happened in the past it still exists. Another might mean, well, actually, you're treating it as if the contract had never come into existence in the first place, in which case that might have a different legal consequence. So I'm not going to get into the detail of that now, because I actually can't remember the detail, but I did write a blog article about it, which seems to have been quite popular.
Yes, I know the blog post you're talking about. I've got it here. Using the right words in contracts, knowing your three R's. Mark's given a little teaser there. He's not going to tell you exactly what the words mean. I think it's repudiate, rescind and revoke, is it?
The three R's for your non-native English speakers is usually used in the context of the basic subjects you learn at school, which don't actually all start with the letter R, but sound like they do, namely reading, writing and arithmetic. So that's usually when people say the three R's, that's what they're talking about. But I'm using it in a somewhat more technical sense.
Yes, go over and get your essential knowledge on Mark's blog. Really, for listeners out there who are interested in IP or working in IP and working with contracts, when you're stuck and you don't know what things mean, or you're just looking for some nice, even some of it's quite light reading, Mark's got quite a sense of humour, go over, check out his articles. I'm going to leave links to some of the most popular and helpful, in my opinion, posts, but certainly peruse, take your time, browse through his articles, because it's got lots of information there.
I've just mentioned the most popular article on the blog, which is about a clause that appears in confidentiality agreements that says that the parties acknowledge that damages will not be an adequate remedy, and that a party will be entitled to apply for injunctive relief. It's one of those clauses that appears particularly in US drafted confidentiality agreements. And there are literally thousands of people all over the globe who've got no idea what this is going on about, but face it in confidentiality agreements. And I just did a little article about what does it mean. And actually, as interesting as the article, I think something like 20 comments on the article from US lawyers and others about exactly what all the subtleties of this phrasing are. I mean, I personally don't think the phrase is necessary in our published template agreements. We don't bother to include it, but you see it a lot. So it's one of those things that is a little puzzling, particularly if you're not familiar with the US legal system.
I love this. And a lot of my listeners, they're interested in the differences between US and UK drafting. And both Ken and Mark write from these different perspectives. And also, it's so helpful reading through the comments from other people to give this other perspective. And listeners, if you've got a perspective and you're looking for a way to practice your legal English writing, well, go ahead and make some comments and contribute to these threads on the blog posts. So thank you very much, Mark. It's been very fruitful today. Thank you.
No problem. I've enjoyed it.
Great. So that's the end of today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and learned something new. Listeners, do head over to studylegalenglish.com/episode98 to get those links to items mentioned in the show, or of course, check your podcast player show notes. If you'd like to get in touch with Mark, if you've got a question or you're interested in connecting with him, do so on LinkedIn. Search for Mark Anderson. Of course, do check out his blog and books. They are excellent resources. So thanks for listening and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Study Legal English podcast. If you really want to get ahead, why not become a member and gain access to many learning resources? Visit studylegalenglish.com/pricing.